Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics, mainly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clarke and my guest is an extremely well-known comics writer. He's also a novelist. He blogs about comics on the Rusty Staples site. He's a chap I keep bumping into at conventions and promising to have him on the book club. It's a very warm welcome to Michael Carroll. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Eamon. Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here. I love what you've done with the place. Yes, we've been meaning to do this for quite a few years, and we're just not getting around to it. But finally, I've tracked you down, and you have no choice now.
Absolutely, yeah. You've got me. So, Michael, we're going to talk about a particular comic that you've worked on. We're going to talk about your own work. But before we get to that, as a first-timer on the book club, we start with comics origin stories. So take us back to your very own first comics that you read and when you got into 2000 AD as well.
Yeah, first comics. I cannot remember the very first ones. I read a lot of the nursery comics as a little kid. I do remember things like Bobo Bunny and all that. They kind of predated me, I think. But my dad's friends, two friends, were barbers. We used to go there every couple of weeks. And they had a stack of really old comics that were, you know, so I was about six, maybe five or six, and I'd read things like their copies of TV 21 and all that sort of thing. I wonder if they still have those comics. No, they probably don't. But so I remember those quite clearly. That's why I always say when it comes to Doctor Who that I had two first Doctors. My first Doctor was Pertwee in the comics and Tom Baker really in the TV show. I do remember Pertwee turning into Tom Baker in the Kingdom of the Planet of Spiders, or whatever it wants to call it. Planet of Spiders, yeah. But I remember that. But I have two Doctor Who origins. And comics-wise, yeah, I pretty sure I remember TV 21, might have even TV Century 21 then. But the one that first comic that really, really blew me away was a very early issue of The Mighty World of Marvel. I think it was issue 5. That's issue 5 is the earliest one I have in my collection. And my dad had gone to London to visit his great aunt, I think it was, and came back with a stack of comics. And this one was, he said, "Oh, this is for you." And I thought, oh, wow, there was the Hulk on the cover. I thought, green monster. Obviously, it's Frankenstein. And my dad's like, "No, that's not how you spell Frankenstein. There's fewer letters than H-U-L-K." But that one stood out for me. That was my first superhero comic that I can recall. I remember Superman on cartoons. I was vaguely aware of Batman, but The Mighty World of Marvel was it for me. It was like, oh, yeah, this is the stuff. So that would have been 1972. I was 6 and a half or thereabouts. And then Pocket Money arrived at some point, and I would buy Mighty World of Marvel, and then Spider-Man Comics Weekly. I discovered that one. I went, oh, it's mostly that Spider-Man. Fantastic. So that happened. And then The Avengers. And it was like, whoa, because I was only buying one at a time. I could only buy one comic a week. So I had to choose, which meant I was always aware of missing out on stuff. And occasionally I would just build someone into the Hornets or the Hotspur. Less so the Victor. I was less into the war comics and sports comics. Well, very, very much less into the sports comics. Actually, that's a weird one. I was aware of Tiger for years before I realized all the stories were sports stories. Somehow I never twigged that. One of my dad's other pals, his much younger brother, donated a stack of Valiant and Lions and all that sort of stuff to me. In my memory, it was a giant black plastic bin bag, probably about 3 feet tall. In reality, it's probably about 20 comics, but it seemed like a huge amount because, you know, we were small and poor. But so that was kind of it. It was mainly Marvel for me, but I did have a good grounding, although quite scattered in British comics. I would read all the comics that came into the house, including my little sister's comics, the Harold Hare or whatever it was. They were Twinkle, God. Where is she now? Whatever happened to Twinkle? What does she do? Folks, if you don't happen to Twinkle, please let us know. We've been concerned these past few years. And yeah, Twinkle's probably dead now. Good Lord. But I liked a lot of humor comics. I loved Sparky and the Beezer. I love things like Whoopi and Shiver and Shake, Wizard and Chips. Brilliant comic. Buster was amazing. Love Buster. And myself and friends would trade comics and swap them and lend them and so on. And somehow I managed to end up with none. Very few of my original comics. I don't know what happened to them. Then in 1977, 2008 came along. We saw I'd been sporadically reading Battle and Action. Because I was buying the Marvel comics, couldn't always afford to buy them. And then 2008 started. So we got the first issue. I went, oh, now I'm home. So I was almost 11 at that stage. My birthday is in the end of March. And so the comic came out about 4 weeks before my birthday. And I was like, ooh. So I think I was the exact right age for it. I was old enough to get a lot of the more adult concepts, or some of them anyway, and young enough to still be thrilled by stuff. And I mean, I wasn't young enough that I believed Targ really was an alien, even though, of course, it turns out he really is. But I went along with it. I thought it was great fun. So yeah, issue one of 2008 is where I came in. And they haven't got rid of me since. I am a limpet clinging to the hull of the mighty vessel of 2008 and slowly dragging it down the way limpets do. So however many years this is later, 47 and a half years later, here we are.
So you're a prog wonner, as we say here on the book club.
Absolutely. I am indeed. I predate most of your readers, I'm sure. And not just in age, but in terms of longevity of service. When I did start writing for 2000 AD, many years later, I was able to triumphantly go back to my mother and say, see? See? Yeah. And then the day I worked out, because I'm weird about numbers and statistics, I worked out one day that I'd finally earned more from 2000 AD than I'd spent on it. And I was like, yes, not only am I quids in, but I still have all those comics. So if you spend your money on alcohol and drugs, then it's all gone. But if you spend your money on comics, you get the comics and then you can read them again and again and again. I mean, seriously, how come more junkies haven't tweaked this? You get your dose of thrill power more than once from a single serving, if you like. So, yeah. So comics, been a huge thing in my life because I never really stopped. I did drift away from 2000 a little bit back in the 90s. I would buy it but not read it. And then every year or so, I'd suddenly go on a mad splurge and just read them all in one go and go, I have no idea what's just happened there. This was in the Brown era. I remember the days when the colours were murky.
Yeah.
And so on. And then, once the 90s kind of fell away, I became much more interested in the possibility of being a creator as well as a consumer. So anyway, that's skipping ahead a bit. But yeah.
When did you make that jump from fan to writer for The Galaxy's Greatest?
It was around, I don't know, sometime in the late 90s, I think I started submitting ideas. I could be wrong about that. I'd already got a lot of books behind me, novels that is, and done one or two comic strips for small press stuff here in Ireland. I think one certainly anyway. Then I remember I met John Higgins, whose name is going to come up again. I met him at an event in Dublin, and I've long been a fan of his work, not just because of Watchmen, then because even before that I was aware of his work. And I met him at this thing. We got on instantly. We sort of fed on a lot of the same horror movies and science fiction stuff, and we were fans of the same kind of comics. We instantly became friends, and he was saying, well, you're a writer, you've done short stories and novels and screenplays even. Why aren't you writing for comics? I don't know how to start. It's too hard. And, but it turns out whining isn't as much a guarantee to success as actually writing. So I remember I pitched a few ideas to the Mighty One, and that time the Mighty One, at one point the Mighty One, when he was Andy Diggle, I remember that, I pitched a Future Shock, wrote a script, sent it in, I should say, and he got back to me with like a page of notes, and I learned more from that page than I did from years of writing novels. Telling short stories is harder than telling long stories. You know, you've got to engage the reader and give them a good time and leave them with something, some sort of resonance. So from Andy, Mr. Diggle, I learned, you know, how to tell a short story in a comic form. That was the start of my learning, I should say. No one has never finished learning. And he said, you know, if you make these changes, restructure the story, pitch it, send it again. We'll see where we go. So I went back and forth and dithered on this. And by the time I got around to actually doing it, Andy had moved on to better things. And Matt Smith had come in to take over. Matt wasn't too keen on the story ideas. That kind of died on the vine. That's almost okay. I mean, I had other things going. Sent him a few ideas. They all got, you know, rightly bounced. And then one day I sent him, I was a judge for a short story competition, the James White Awards, after the famous science fiction writer. And I was one of the perennial judges, and I made a list as kind of a joke of all of the science fiction tropes that we don't want to see anymore. We do not want to see stories about robots that turn into masters, or time travel, or JFK, or Marilyn Monroe, or Elvis Presley, or whatever. Made a whole list of them. Then one day, for fun, I thought, what if you had one story that combined all of these things? It just, I didn't get that far, but I did come up with the idea of Adolf Hitler, his scientists built a time machine so he could go back in time to tell his younger self not to fight the war on two fronts, because that's pretty much why the Nazis lost the Second World War. Oh, well, one of the reasons. They were stupid. Nazis bad, I have decided over the years. But, so I pitched that to the Mighty One, sent him a script, and he said, this doesn't work, and that was weird. And so he said, if you make these changes, I'll take another look at it. So I made some changes, sent it in, and he said, send me an invoice. And I went, hey. So I went to my wife and said, how do I do an invoice? What's that exactly? I've never had to do one of those before. So that was weird. So the first one was in, and then it was drawn by Gary Erskine, who I was a fan of Gary's work. And I'm thinking, oh my God, they're starting me at the top. They've given me Gary Erskine to. So that blew me away. And then I didn't get another Future Shock in until for a year and a half later. And it was drawn by John Cooper, of all people. I remember his work from really early days, from way before 2018. And that was amazing. And then what happened after that? Did a few things for the magazine. I've been writing for 2000 AD Review website, Saturday Mist now, great website. Had a column under the name Sprout. It was pseudonymous until people realized who I was. Actually, it's almost something people realized I wasn't Gordon Rennie, because they were sure I was Gordon Rennie. But so I pitched the idea of doing a few of those for the magazine. They didn't quite work. My format didn't fit theirs, and Matt asked me to, you know, to do like top 10 lists rather than actual just free flowing nonsense the way I was writing. But he obviously became aware I was someone who could deliver on the deadline with at least reasonable quality. That's a clip, or a tip, I should say, for readers and potential writers. Don't miss the deadlines. It's not fun. It's not cute. Oh, I miss deadlines. Oh, I'm so naughty. No, it's not naughty. It's screwing everything up for everybody else. Hit your deadlines. Deliver early. But anyway, Matt said, do you want to pitch some ideas for the Tales from the Black Museum? So again, one-off stories, but they're set in Judge Dredd's universe. You're not allowed to use Judge Dredd himself. That said, I did sneak him into the very last panel of my first Tales from the Black Museum. I did a couple of those, and he said, do you want to pitch some ideas for Judge Dredd? And I went, do I? Yes. Turns out, yes, he didn't actually have to ask, but he asked because he's polite. So that was it. Yeah, that was kind of the way in. I seemed to go from zero to dread very, very quickly, in some regards. But then in other regards, it already had considerably over 1 million words published at that stage. So yeah, I kind of knew a bit about writing. At least I knew where commas go. And that you don't put a space before the comma, lads. Please. Ever.
And here we are nearly 25 years later, and you're in the prog as we speak, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a moment when we get to it. So, Michael, let's go to, you've mentioned his name already. You've mentioned John Higgins. Tell us the book that you've chosen to come on the book club and talk about.
The book that I've chosen? Really? Yeah, okay. The book that has been chosen by the gods. It's Razorjack. John Higgins is not only a wonderful artist, he's a great storyteller. So he created the character of Razorjack, this very evil extra-dimensional being, who basically decided, let's be the only one, let's kill all other life in the universe, because why not? He self-published his own comic back in the late 90s, I think it was 99, Razorjack, which had first episode of his new Razorjack story, plus a few of the bits and pieces, including, I think it was the first two episodes of World Without End, which is a fantastic thing he did with Jamie Delano a few years before. And so Razorjack was John's creation from the ground up. And then the first issue, as he will say himself, if you really want to lose a house, the best way to do it is to go into publishing. The first issue didn't take off the way he should have. It was certainly the way he didn't take off the way he would have liked. Story was never finished. Well, I say never. It felt like forever later, Com.x came out with the two-issue Razorjack story. It was 2 years later. It felt like forever back then because, time was different in the old days. Comics came out with their version. Then they did a collected version of the whole Razorjack story. And a few years after that, I think it was 2012, 2013, John basically sold the whole thing as a package to Titan Books or Titan Comics, whichever one it was. Titan Comics or Titan Books, I can never remember. Titan Comics, it says on this one. So they did a lovely hardcover, sort of remastered version of Razorjack. And John asked me to take a look at the script and the dialogue. The issues, the two sort of pieces of Razorjack didn't quite line up because John had taken so much time between issues and versions of it. And they were tectonic plates that didn't quite match. So John asked me to rewrite the dialogue and smooth it out. Mostly rewrite the dialogue was, in fact, a case of checking punctuation and stuff like that. He had some of the characters speaking in accents. You know the way Gambit does in mm-hmm. X-Men?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that multiplied by 100 and then add 7. It's quite hard to read in the original one. So I stripped out almost all of that. Rewrote an awful lot of the dialogue to help the story to kind of flow. So my job as a scripter was to take what was already there and, disassemble it and then reassemble it in the same order, but just, a bit smoother. And I think John was happy with what I did because he still talks to me. he hasn't yet killed me. Yeah, so we John had done the original Razorjack story, then a short 4-6 pager, I think it was, something like that. And then he asked me to do another one just to pad out, new material for the bonus feature section on your DVD. So I wrote a standalone story called Glimpse of Summer, which ties in with the whole Razorjack world that I'd been kind of building because, alongside John, we also did John was expanding the idea of Razorjack into other media. He had music and stuff like that, various photographic exhibitions. And I did a novel. Based set in the Razorjack universe, as it were, or universe heads. And yeah, that was a weird one. So because a novel is very different to a comic, comics are always done in the third person. You're always looking over the shoulder of the character at the very least, if not looking directly at the main character. So a novel will be more inclined to be, can be more internal, introspective, seeing out through the eyes of a character rather than seeing them from a distance. So, yeah. So I wrote this novel, Double Crossing, which is designed to run parallel, if you like, to many of the events of the Razor Jack graphic novel. I set it in London because it's a city I love so much. I absolutely love that place. And I had an absolute ball. I've been writing kids' books for years, you know, young adult science fiction, superhero stories. I've written a couple of adult novels under an assortment of pseudonyms, including a bunch of romance novels. And my Razor Jack novel, Double Crossing, was the first time I was ever really able to kind of let loose with the violence and the bad language and the naughtiness and referring to adult pursuits. And I had a ball right now. I don't know how well the book actually reads now to the five or maybe six readers who've actually bought it, but it was tremendous fun to write. I should probably go back and give it a polish and do a new version. But yeah, so anyway, yeah, the myself and John, we worked out, we sort of ironed out some of his ideas for Razor Jack as this extra-dimensional, ultra-powerful being who travels, you know, well, whose minions travel across the universe and wage war. And the idea was to have three novels. Mine was the first. Then Al Ewing wrote one, and then John wrote one himself. And it was back in the comics days, in fact. So the first novel of mine was published. Sort of a small print run, like kind of a launch print run, 50 issues. And that was it. It never went anywhere. So the publisher didn't quite know what to do with a text novel, a prose. I like to call it a text-only graphic novel, but no one knew what to do with it. So it kind of died almost. But nevertheless, you know, I revived it many years later as an ebook. Al didn't want his book to go any further. So I think John and I are the only ones who read that. It is quite brilliant. I mean, if you've read much Al Ewing, and if you haven't, you should. He is one of the world's great storytellers. It's fantastic work. John's book, The Iced Heart, was so cut out of John's brain. It was remarkable. Not the best prose-wise. I did a lot of editing on that to kind of hone it into shape. This is a file off the rough edges. And I'm sure John himself would really admit it. He's not a natural prose storyteller. It was quite tricky for him to get there. I mean, the story itself is very strong. The telling of it needed a bit of editing. That was the Iced Heart, that's what we call it. Yeah, it was very good. These could have gone really far, but they didn't. But then that's true of so many projects that we work on as creators. All the things that didn't happen. We can't dwell on the stuff that didn't happen because it didn't happen. We have to focus on the things that did happen or the things that may yet happen. So, yeah, I had a ball with Razor Jack. I mean, it was my first introduction to working with Titan Comics and my last. So there you go. They never came back to me. I did bounce a few ideas off some of the editors a few years ago. We never got any traction. Somehow they can see the evil in me that Matt Smith can't. So he's blind to my flaws, to my foibles. But yeah, that was it was good fun. Razor Jack, the idea, of course, isn't dead because about 5 or 6 years ago, I think myself and John did a Judge Dredd Razor Jack crossover story. We had a ball with that one. That was so much fun. I wrote the whole story outline and sent it to John, and he bounced a few ideas back. So we sort of incorporated them together, wrote the script, worked really well. And then we came to do work on the second one. and we could not agree on certain aspects of the story. We didn't fall out over it. We just couldn't find common ground. We knew where we wanted it to go, but how to get there was the hard part. So it hasn't happened yet. It may well still happen. One of the problems was John wanted to introduce this character who was, to my mind, was too powerful. A character who was basically could turn into kind of a mist. In the same way that the T2 or the T-1000, whatever it is, in Terminator 2, could turn into liquid. This thing could turn into a mist and then reform itself elsewhere. And I would, yeah, but then if you do that, you have to have reasons why the hero can stop them. If you give a character a tremendous ability, it has to have a flaw or at least some aspect of it that shows, yeah, oh, hang on, they are defeatable. And we argued over this for days, possibly weeks. Just go, no, I don't want to do that. And also, how do you paint mist in a threatening way? You can't do it. It's rubbish. Actually, if anybody could paint mist in a threatening way, it would be John, because he is that good. But yeah, the door, I think, is still open. Or at least there's a crack in the dimensions between where we are now and where we might be. With the whole concept of Razor Jack is ultimately very strong. I think it's not gone yet. It's been 25 years now since John started it, so that's not bad. 25 years and a couple of hundred pages worth of stuff. You know, that's pretty good. I would like to I would like the novel to have done a bit better than it did. But, you know, you can't win them all. That's Razor Jack.
So you've mentioned, as you say, that she's this sort of extra-dimensional, super-powerful creature who's got her her goals to destroy all other dimensions, including, of course, ours. And then on Earth, you get the sort of the police procedural, the two cops in the John Higgins stories, Frame and Ross, who sort of start to realise there's what would we call it? Some incursions going on from...
Yeah, it is. There's a sort of confluence of events that Frame and Ross are more or less ordinary cops in effectively an ordinary Earth, and then this, as I say, this incursion happens in Razor Jack's dimension. There's been we learn gradually there's been sort of a long running battle between herself, who's like the side of darkness, and there's Lady Helen, who's the side of good. And as the story opens, Lady Helen has been captured and imprisoned. And Razor Jack is raising her army of that grown psychopathic warrior women called Twist Bitches. I was never comfortable using that word in a story, but you know, if we think of them as being savages and mongrels, it's easier to use the word than if they're just women. And Razor Jack needs to garner power to destroy her nemesis, and she does that by tapping into other dimensions. John and I talked about the novel, I quickly made it clear that you know there's so many elements going on that they aren't necessarily all folding together as neatly as we might like. Partly because I kind of think some elements of it John was just throwing in because he thought it would be cool, rather than serving the story as a whole. So when we did the Double Crossing novel and we were working on it, I kind of built some rules based on what John had already done to see how it works. Is that it's like the universe is held together, the multiverse or whatever is held together by these core universes, core, like key ones, and ours, Earth, is one of the ones that they didn't know about, and they suddenly go, oh, what's this? And so Razor Jack is desperate to get to Earth, but they have this sort of trans-dimensional bridge technology that she's actually too powerful to use, so effectively she's too big to come through the hole, as it were. So she has to send, she can use her influence to influence people over here, or she can send certain of her warriors over. So that means that takes Razorjack more out of the story. See, we only see her a few times in the novel, at least. The best baddies are the ones that you don't see, the ones who work in the shadows. It's the same thing with monster stories. I think it was in Dance Macabre that Stephen King said that when the monster's on the other side of the closed door, it's, and I'm assuming it's not a glass door, a closed, opaque door, it's much more scary than when you open the door and see what it is. Yes, it might still be terrifying, but at least you have some concept of how to deal with it. So if you know the villain's plan in any story, it kind of takes the magic away a little bit. At the end of your spy movie, when you realize what the bad guy's been up to after all along, you go, oh, okay, yeah, now I get it. The mystery is more intriguing than the answers sometimes, so you don't always have to supply answers. With Razorjack, so I kind of put her into a back room for most of the novel, and certainly going forward, that's what I would like to do. She will appear now and again, but not a lot. You can overuse a villain as well. I mean, we've seen this happen with Judge Death. There was a time when we just went, oh, this guy again. He stops being scary. So keep him kind of, at a distance. So with the double crossing of my novel, then I said, as I say, I laid down rules and guidelines for how it plays out. A lot of it wasn't tremendously clear as to what was going on in the graphic novel, because there was so much happening. So I would, if I had my way, I would completely disassemble it and get John to redraw an awful lot of it and tell slightly different stories. There's a character introduced at the very beginning, a young man who's arrived in this kind of unnamed city who's in trouble. But we never find out who he is or what he's there for. I'm not saying that he had a purpose other than to introduce the rest of the characters, but it comes across as though he's a main character, and turns out he totally isn't. So there are things like that that in hindsight are much more visible than they would have been in the development stage. And that happens in a novel as well, of course, but if you tell a story in a serial format, you're kind of stuck with the beginning. If I were, for example, writing a multi-part Judge Dredd story and delivering each episode as it goes, then I can't go, oh, yeah, hang on, that doesn't work, and change the beginning. Actually, I actually discovered that last year, I think it was, when I wrote an eight-parter called In the Event of My Untimely Demise. I was most of the way through the story to write the script, and the Mighty One got in touch and said, where's that script? Can I have it soon? Not that I was late or anything like that. It's just he wanted it soon. I went, I'm not quite ready. And he asked me to send him what I had, and I declined. Because I knew that by the time I got to the end, I would want to go back and polish some of the beginning, which is always how I work. So even though I knew what the story was from the get-go, sometimes you have to go back and drop a few scenes in or take a few out. With serialized storytelling, you can't always do that. Dickens had the same thing. If he introduces a character at the beginning of one of his chapbooks, they might not show up again. You know, that happens in a few of them. Because he forgot about them or realized, oh, no, they aren't important after all. That happens in the Razorjack book. And it happens an awful lot in comics where someone's telling an episode, episode by episode. But, yeah, so it was... It was fun to play in the Razorjack universe, given that really, as a storyteller, only John had been in there before. So I kind of shouldered my way in and went, no. This is how you do it. And he indulged me and went, absolutely, yeah, that's great. And then just ignored me. When I was doing, we did the Glimpse of Summer short story at the back of the Titan edition. I wrote this really tight script. And then when John drew it, he got about halfway through and went, ah, no, when he redrew the ending completely, the last, I think, three or four pages are not what I wrote. The very ending is, but the little epilogue is. The rest is like, what the hell is this? So I had to rewrite the script to make it work with what John had drawn. And that took longer than it did to write the script in the first place. So that's one I won't let go every time I meet him. I'll bring it up. But... in terms of storytelling, you see, the artist is nearly always right. So that's what I've learned over the years in comics. If the artist has a better way of doing something, they're going to be right most of the time. I mean, by most, I mean like 90% of the time. Unless they're a brand new artist and they're very fresh out of the gate, in which case they should just do what they're bloody well told. That's why we write a script. But for someone like John, or if I was working with Colin McNeil or one of the really seasoned artists, if I say do it this way and they go, no, I go, yeah, you're right. So I had that with PJ Holden years ago. I had a detailed page and he just went, no, that's not how you draw it. And he drew it his way and went, oh, he is so right. My way was boring and uninteresting. But yeah, that happens. But yeah, the artist's job, you see, is to tell a story to the world. I tell a story to the artist. The artist tells it to the rest of the world. The artist, the colorist, the inker, the letterer. There's the work that gets judged before mine does. So, you know, they're usually going to be right. Not always.
Well, while you mention them, let me just quickly mention. So it's mostly drawn. Well, it's drawn all by John Higgins, mostly coloured by John. Sally Jane Hurst comes in and colours the last two separate stories that are in the back of this book. Letters by Eddie Dighton, John Chappell, and Mark McKenzie Ray. This is in the Titan version from 2013, rather nice hardback. Introduction at the front by John, and some sketches and character designs at the back as well. You've already mentioned that you crossed over Razorjack into the Judge Dredd universe in the magazine 396 to 398 back in 2018. But also in your Glimpse of Summer story at the back of this book, you give us the idea that the Razorjack can cause an incursion into other times. So you go back to feudal Japan and tell a sort of Ronin samurai story, which is fantastic. How was doing that, apart from obviously the wrangles over the ending?
Yeah, that was, thank you. That was a lot of fun to do. I love that period. Though I'm, I have to, I mean, I totally forgot this one recently. When I wrote the original script, John gave it to a friend of his who is either Japanese or understands much more about Japanese literature and well, Japanese era than I do of the time. So they corrected all the names. I put in a few Japanese names I thought were appropriate. They went, no, that's not how you do it. Yeah, I had great fun writing that one. Partly because it was my, I think it was my first foray into the, well, certainly the comic Razorjack world, where it was entirely my idea and entirely my story. I wanted to establish that in other dimensions, time doesn't necessarily work in the same way as ours. So if they need a powerful event to weaken the bridges or weaken the walls between the dimensions, we could use something like the eruption of Mount Fuji and as a kind of a, well, literally a world-shattering event. So that's what happens in the story, that this eruption happens and then this being appears because she has, you know, this is one of the warriors from Razorjack's realm has found her way into our reality. It's a gateway in. And she's trying to kill, spoils the story, what the hell, she's trying to kill the ancestor of one of the main protagonists of John's strips. So yeah, I had a lot of fun writing that. It's only 8 pages, but I think it worked well, and John's art on it is sublime, and Sally's coloring, of course, too. Sally gets sidelined, not necessarily deliberately, but certainly frequently. Her work as a colorist is phenomenal, but she's also a brilliant artist in her own right and an incredible musician. She's an amazing singer. But yeah, so myself and John and Sally have known each other forever and ever and ever. I knew Sally and John before they were a couple. I knew them separately. And I'm not saying I introduced them because I didn't. But yeah, so they were both friends of mine before they got together. So we've known each other collectively for, let's say 25 years each. That's 75 years So that's not bad going. So I think we're a good team, especially when it comes to the storytelling. John has such great, very strong ideas. When he gets something into his head, he says, "We're doing it this way." Then we're doing it that way because he's so hard to argue with, but he's also very wise, very funny. So we get on well. I think we the fiction between us creates the right kind of sparks. It doesn't sort of set the house on fire. I've had a lot of fun working on stuff with John, and there's more to come. But I that's for the future. Razorjack has been a constant thing that pops up every now and again. It was, we must do this, we must do that. And it's hopefully we'll be able to take it further somewhere down the road. It'd be nice to get back to the whole idea of the multimedia thing, the music and the plays and so on forth.
Great stuff. Well, the Razorjack hardback is still available for about a tenner. You can find it for original cover price $14.99, but I think you can get it cheaper than that now. And your novel, Razorjack Double Crossing, is available on Kindle Unlimited, but it's also, you can buy it for the whopping price currently of 99p, Michael.
Is that how much it is?
That's currently how it is today, yes.
Yeah. I did that thing, Amazon lets you do this thing where you can do kind of a countdown where one day the price is 99p, the next day it's 150, then and so on. I did that a few years ago in the hope of boosting sales, and it did not work. I don't think I sold more than about 4 copies in the entire time. It's one of those weird ones because people who have read it all the way to the end, at least, have gone, "My God, this is really good," and it's quite exciting and quite funny and really violent. Oh my God, it's so violent. But I do suspect in that novel that it's too opaque at the start. It starts off in Razor Jack's other dimension, and I probably should have started it off here. The basic idea behind that story is that there's a small time crook in London stumbles across a very big haul and thinks, "Ooh, we can get this," and they're going to do a deal with a big crook. A kind of a ganglord who's one of the most fun characters I've ever written. But our hero, being an idiot, thinks, I could pretend that the shipment. But what happens is they stumble across a 200, 300 year old forgotten batch of bottles of whiskey, which are now worth a fortune. And he basically fakes destroying all this whiskey so that he can later on sell it. To get some money from the guy he sold to originally and then sell it somewhere else. He double crosses him, hence the name Double Crossing. And at this time, Razorjack's minions are trying to find a way into our reality. They get a way in and they want a specific item that I can't say, but they realize, hang on a minute, this ganglord is the guy we need to pull the right sort of strings to get the specific artifacts that they want. They're MacGuffin. And it's the same ganglord that our hero Kevin Dixon is up against. So we end up with this story where the ganglord teams up with one of Razorjack's warriors, who have called Katana. Because I didn't know there was a DC character called Katana at the time. Or at least if I did know, I'd forgotten. And anyway, so she is an alien, comes to Earth, and she has to hunt down our hero. And it's a madcap chase across back and forth across London. And I think at one point he's on a bicycle. But we had a lot of fun with that story. It was really good getting the letting go of all the chains and restrictions that I'd had from writing the kids' books. It's the kids' books. You're not really allowed to be violent or to have swear words. I mean, there's one scene in the Razorjack graphic, or my prose novel, where she, Katana, kicks a guy so hard in the face that his jawbone passes out through the back of his neck and hits the guy behind him. I don't know if that's even possible, but it is in my story. So after all the kids' books were really, we had to be very careful. Everything we said had to be monitored. I was just let loose on this thing. And I think I went a bit crazy, like a dog being let off its leash in the park. I just ran and ran and ran and wagged my little tail and barked my head off, and chased all the butterflies, attacked a squirrel, and so on. I had a great time. And then getting me back into my pen afterwards was pretty tricky. It was very hard to go back to writing the kids' books after being let off the leash there. But yeah, it was good fun. And it might not be the best story ever written, but I had a ball with it. It was, yeah, it was silly but funny. And some great jokes, I think.
Michael, let's play the Grail Page game, which we do on this podcast, where we imagine the artwork from the books we're talking about is available and we can afford it. Going back to Razor Jack, I think we're going to get to that final story that you did with John and Sally Jane Hurst. What's the page you've chosen as your Grail page?
I am flipping through it at the moment because I can't remember what page number it is. Hold on. This one. Okay. I'm torn between page one and page two. Of A Glimpse of Summer. Oh, and there's 10 points for anybody who can tell me where that title comes from. Or the third last page has the hero effectively standing his ground, which I think is important for the story. Instead of having always being on the run from this creature that's coming after him, he finally realizes, as he's told early on by his one true love. His one true love says to him at the beginning of the story, "But a true warrior does not sit and wait for death. A true warrior stands." And then he does at the end. He realizes, actually, he's just too tired to go on any further. But I like that one a lot. And John's art is sublime. Sally's colouring is so subtle and beautiful here. It's almost a black and white story until the very end when the sun comes back again. So, yeah, I'm going to go for that one. So that would be page... Hang on. Yeah, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Page 6 of the overall story,
right?
I think. And for viewers watching in black and white, that's still page 6. So, yeah. I've seen some of the original artwork from A Glimpse of War when John had his exhibition back in Liverpool Victoria Museum. They dedicated a whole wing of the museum to him. And one of his pages from A Glimpse of Summer was on display. And I was so, so proud. At the launch of his book, John did a sort of autobiographical art book.
Oh, yes, I remember.
Beyond Watchmen and Judge Dredd. Yeah, edited by, what was his name? Oh, me. That's who edited. But yeah, at the launch of the book, I was standing next to this picture all the time, pointing at people. I wrote that. And that was mine. I wrote it. Of course, the left wing wasn't on the page that was on display. But I go, no, I'm the one who wrote what it looks like. But yeah, that was a great page for me. I think that would be the best one to pick. Although, you know, John's such a great artist. So much of his work. I mean, some of the work that he did on the Razor Jack and Dredd crossover, This Corrosion is called. Also named after a song. That was some gorgeous work there. Oh, no, I'm going to stick with my page 6 of A Glimpse of Summer. And if you're listening, John, wherever you are now, God, south of England, probably. Yeah, that's the one I want, John. You may give me that one as a present. Thank you. My birthday is coming up next year, so my birthday year. So,
excellent stuff. Well, I'll post these images of that page and also the first two pages from that story when this episode comes out in September. People can see what we've been talking about with the lovely John Higgins art and Sally Jane Hurst colouring. Great stuff. Thank you, Michael. We're going to turn to your own projects now. We've mentioned your Razor Jack novel. You mentioned on your own website that you've written 40-ish novels. More than that now, probably.
Yeah, I only realized today the last novel I wrote was Necessary Evil, one of the the Judges series. I think that was the last one that came out. So it's been a few years. I haven't written any novels since then. But yeah, I've done a lot. I did romance novels for a while under a female pseudonym very early in my career. That was It was good training. Really was good training because I had to write for an audience that I wasn't used to. I fell into that by accident. The opportunity came up. Do you want to write a romance novel? Yes, I do. Because it will there be money? Yes, there will. Then yes, I definitely do. Anyway, yeah, the first one sold really well. Actually, what was weird was that I had this deal with publisher over here, Poulbeck, famous for their romance fiction. They used to call them airport books. And we had a deal. I would write three of these. And the money was quite good per book. It wasn't great. The first one came out and sold like gangbusters, which was great. So they immediately signed me up to do a further four, making seven in total, with much bigger advance, lots more money for me. Hey, this is great. And then almost immediately after that, a major distributor in the UK went bust. Can't remember the name of the distributor. But anyway, they went bust owing an awful lot of publishers an awful lot of money. And that meant that the people in Poolbeg went, we're screwed. We can't afford to cover any of our costs. We're not going to get, if we can't distribute the books, we won't be able to sell them. So we kind of had to curtail everything. I ended up with four of the seven books I wrote got published, of the seven big romances for them got published. And they're not the best books I've ever written, but they were good fun. And again, I learned an awful lot by writing. So there's still three more that I wrote. So effectively lost a couple of years' work that I would never got paid for.
Yeah.
The books are sitting on my hard drive. The only people who've read all of them are actually my wife is the only one who's read them apart from me. And I can't remember what happens in one of them. There's one of them I know I wrote it, but I have no clue what it's about. I must read it again one day. That was quite an eye-opener because I honestly thought I've made it. The first one had sold so well, I thought, I'm in. This is my calling. Yes, it's not science fiction. It's not horror or fantasy. They're just romance tales. But, hey, money. And then to have that cruelly whipped away from me by fate and reality. Yeah, that was a tough blow. It was no one's fault. It was literally just the way the dice fell. But yeah, I didn't let that get me down. Oh no, I did. But I still picked myself up and kept going. I think the next big thing I did was the kids' superhero books, which I started writing before the Harry Potter thing kicked in and everybody was writing kids' books. So I did the superhero series, and that was good fun. Again, didn't take off quite the way I'd hoped, but then, you know, that's often the case. Certainly, by that stage, I was writing full-time anyway, so it was I was making enough money to keep myself from going back to programming. So it was good fun. End up with the superhero series. There was a bunch of short stories and nine novels in the end. That was good fun. And then, yeah, I did a lot of ghostwriting, some of which I still cannot talk about. Actually, even just saying I did that is probably, I'm probably breaching some NDA somewhere. But I've written books for other people with their names on the cover, which is a weird sort of thing to do. Books are kind of like long distance time separation telepathy. I think of words and those words appear in someone else's head further down the line. So people reading these books will have the vague sense that all of the words were written by the person whose name was on the cover. And they weren't in some cases. Yeah. I mean, I won't say much more than that, but when you ghostwrite, you know from the beginning you don't have ownership of this thing. That it's a job for hire. You generally won't even get royalties. You get an advance payment, so it's usually a third on signing, a third on delivery, then a third on publication. Or that's the way it used to be. And that's your lot. So if it sells 1 million copies, the person whose name was on the front will get the benefits of that. the person who ghost wrote it will then be able to use that for the next project and say, oh, hang on a minute, I wrote this one. But since you can't publicly stand up and say, I wrote this book, then you're kind of stuck. So the publishers will know, maybe, but the public can't know. So yeah, that's about as accurate and concise as I can get on that subject. But again, it's tremendous training ground because you're writing in someone else's voice, in a way, especially if you're a part of a series that someone else has established. I mean, we all know, for example, that Alfred Hitchcock didn't really write the Three Investigators books.
Yeah.
amazingly. No, to be honest, no one ever thought he did.
No.
But you have to try and be consistent with what's gone before. So that's, again, when you're writing or creating any kind of story, if you're given an empty page, you can do whatever you want. But you will do your best writing when you're given limitations. If someone says you can only write in this specific field, this specific way, you will find that the stumbling blocks become stepping stones. The obstacles, you scale the obstacles to reach greater heights, basically. Or you can just go, I can't do it, and you fall apart. But most writers, I think, will rise to the challenge and do things, become more creative. It doesn't mean that you can only work with limitations, but certainly one example from the world of Judge Dredd comes from Chaos Day, where John Wagner decided, you know what we're going to do? We're going to destroy 90% of the city. And the rest of us writers who had a whole bunch of stories all lined up, ready to go, went, what's this again? no. But because of what happened with the Day of Chaos stuff, I wrote a multi-parter called The Forsaken about a bunch of missing cadets.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, I don't know how well it was received, but I thought it was great, and I wouldn't have been able to write that without the spanner in the ointment that John had thrown us with the Day of Chaos stuff. It would never have occurred to me to write that story. And of course, the field wasn't there in which the story can take place. So, with writing, if you give yourself limitations, it really does help. I mean, when I'm teaching, which doesn't happen so often these days, but I will say to the students, what you should do is you should watch half of a TV show that you're not familiar with, just the first half, and then write the second half, and then write a different first half that ties in with your second half. So you have one coherent story that's completely original. Well, you're not completely original, but it's really hard to do. It's really hard. And that's why you should do it. If it was easy, anybody could do it. If it's hard and you succeed, that's a much greater triumph. So you learn an awful lot more along the way. With these things if you give yourself restrictions and limitations or they're imposed upon you by the medium, by writing romance novels that you weren't expecting to have to do, that's how you learn. You don't learn from when things are easy, you learn when things are hard.
Well, sounds a bit glib. We can find details of your 40-ish novels that do have your name on them on your website, michaelowencarroll.com. Look in the show notes for this episode for details of that. Of course, you mentioned sci-fi and horror. We can also find you at the moment in the pages of the Prog, where you've just wrapped up Proteus Vex with Jake Lynch. And now you've started a new complete story, Silver, with the artist Joe Curry. Tell us about Silver.
Yes, Silver came about because I finished Vex, and I was saying to Matt, what are you looking for? And he basically said he wanted... He knew Joe was coming available. He wanted Joe in the Prog, and he said, "Do something with him." Sort of almost like a heavy metal type story, mad as you like. Basically, he said something odd as you like. It was the very first idea I had would have been brilliant, except it would have been pretty much impossible to draw, so that didn't work. I will come back. I will tell you what that was, because we'll find a way to get there at some point. But with Silver, what I wanted a as something that we hadn't really seen before in 2000 AD, which basically is this alien invasion story, but it starts 30 years after the invasion happened. So we have the occupation is well underway. There's a whole generation of people who've only known life under the rule of these beings, these aliens. And but of course, to introduce the story, you have to have a character who doesn't really know. Well, it helps have a character who doesn't know what's going on. So then that's where I come up with the idea of the Baroness. And basically, she's a vampire. So we have vampires and aliens in the one story. There's kind of an unwritten rule in fantasy-type fiction that you don't mix things too much. You don't make too many leaps away from the present, the real world. You introduce one element, and then, especially with science fiction, you introduce one element and you kind of run with that. Like whether it's robots or time travel or whatever. But the more you start mixing in, they have to have some coherence. Otherwise, you're going to have stories that just got everything mixed in, all the bits and pieces, anything goes, and then it turns into Doctor Who. And no, not disparaging Doctor Who for what it is, but it's not science fiction anymore. It's magic. It's fantasy. The sonic screwdriver is magic, let's be honest. And so I've always been reluctant to do any kind of genre mixing, but the more I thought about this idea, the more I liked it. And then Joel was on board with it, Matt was on board. And yeah, so basically the Baroness is a 500-year-old vampire. We haven't in the story established the rules of vampires as such. The first book is really an introduction. It's setting the ground. I'm actually right now, I'm in the middle of the story for book two, which takes things a little further. So we see more about what's going on. But it's not designed like Proteus Vex, which is plotted really, really tightly. Proteus Vex was always designed to end the way it did. Not quite when it did, but it was designed to end in that way. This one is more more open-ended, I think. So depending on what the reactions are from the readers and from what Joe wants to write and what Matt wants to say, we can steer the story in any number of ways. But mainly it's about just coming up with Matt's stuff and see if we can make them work in the tale. Joe's art is so good. He keeps on sending these sketches and I'm going, this could, we can't use this, but we will use this. We'll find a way. So yeah, he's very good at that. He's got a brilliant sort of sideways imagination where he comes up with stuff that you go, that doesn't tie in. But then again, if we did this and if we did that. So yeah, he's it's a joy to work with him. And not that it wasn't a joy to work with Jake and Jim on Proteus Vex, because I still think Proteus Vex is the best thing I've ever written. But Silver's a lot of fun because it is just mad. And there's some scenes coming up in when there's a thing at the end of book two that for the past week I've been going, no, we'll save on that one for book three. But if we put it into book two, then I go, no. It's too good to have the original ending and this bit tacked on. So I still haven't decided. When I come to write the script, I will decide whether that little twist goes into book two or book three. It is a lot of fun to write. It's much more fun writing these things than it is writing Judge Dredd. Because in Judge Dredd, you can't make too many changes because John Mack will just come along and undo them. And also, you know, I'm not the only one in that playground. I'm not the only one steering the ship, as it were. So we're only allowed to do certain things that otherwise the Mighty One would go, no, we don't go there. We're not allowed to give Judge Dredd a moustache, for example. Oh, man, imagine how cool that would be. But so, yeah, with Silver, I mean, myself and Joe can just go wherever we want, pretty much. And Matt might go, no, it doesn't go there. But for the most part, we have great fun. And there's, I said it in the year 2001 because I wanted to have a weird sort of pre-1970s aesthetic to the machinery and the clothes and all that sort of stuff. So the invasion of Earth happens in 1969, which was a key year in our history anyway. Vietnam, moon landings, I turned 3. All of these important key events that we all remember. So all of the technology, all the human technology in Silver predates the microchip, effectively. there aren't computers, there aren't cell phones. Telephones are dial-up jokes, or they're giant walkie-talkies. There's nothing. There's no smart fridges, for example, letting you know that you're low on orange juice. So the aliens have got all the tech, and the humans are just scrambling by with leftover World War II material. So that's been a lot of fun. It gives the feel a different feel and look to the story.
Excellent stuff. So that's running in the prog, book one of Silver, as we speak, and presumably will still be running in September when this episode comes out.
It should be just about over then.
Just about finishing, right. Just wrapping up. And it's a terrific new addition to the pages of the prog. Really enjoying it, and Joe's art as well. So one other thing I'm going to ask you about, Michael, is that you were also, despite being very busy with all this stuff we're talking about, you also managed to maintain the Rusty Staples blog at michaelowencarroll.wordpress.com. Again, link in the show notes. Just tell us, tell the listeners quickly, what is the Rusty Staples blog about?
Oh, well, Rusty is an excuse for me to waffle on about comics that aren't my comics. I waffle on about mostly British comics, because there's an awful lot of websites talking about and blogs talking about American comics. There's not as many talking about British comics. There are some brilliant stuff out there by people like Steve Holland and Richard Sheaf, and obviously downthetubes.net, which, you know, very close to our hearts. But it sort of came about because I really wanted to show off what I knew about and stuff. And then the more I worked on it, the more I realized how little I knew about comics. But I think the most fun I've had has been doing the comics timelines. They originally started out as family trees, linking all of the comics together. Years ago, there was a comics website that did family trees of British comics. The way Lion was absorbed by Valiant, or whichever way around it went, this kind of thing, and then which one led up to that, and all of these. So there was a family tree thing, and I don't know what website it was, but it disappeared. So I started trying to recreate that, and then doing the comics as timelines rather than family trees gives us a different mental picture of how it all comes together, which comics run at the same time. I've had a lot of fun with them. They're such hard work to do. And every now and again, you come across a new one that should be part of the tree, and you go, oh, no, this means moving everything. And it's not like, I've written programs that will generate the data, but I haven't written anything that generates the images, because I'm not that good as a programmer. But it is a lot of fun, but it's a pain, especially when someone comes along just after you've published something, and they go, ah, but what about this? And you go, no! I've just spent a week on this, and now I've got it redoing. But yeah, so between the timelines and the Hatch Match and Dispatch articles, which I'm actually currently working on the one for next month. So it'll come out at the end of this month. It will be September, and that will be the 60th. So that's 5 years of doing Hatch Match and Dispatch. And Hatch Match Dispatch, for those who don't know, it's basically lists of British comics that are noting an important anniversary, usually of their creation or their demise. And I tended to do it in 5-year jumps. So, you know, you don't note the 49th anniversary of a comic, but you will note the 50th or the 55th. Well, now we're coming up to 5 years, which means that in October, the issue, if I do it, the episode will be retreading the same ground as the very first one. And given the fact that it's a lot of work and doesn't get an awful lot of views, I'm probably going to call it a day. The next one in September is when I go, yeah, that's it. It takes a day and a half to write these things, to find the information and all that sort of stuff. And when you get 24 views, you go, eh. I mean, I don't know if you notice yourself, Eamon, but sometimes you put a lot of work into something and it goes nowhere, and you just go, why did I do this? Like, you know, in a day and a half, I could at the very least have, written 10 pages of a comic script. And that's money. Spending a day and a half writing something for Rusty Staples or, you know, something else is not money. That's lack of money. In fact, it's negative money. So I am vacillating at the moment as to whether or not to keep it going. I might, but I might not. If I get enough support, I will probably keep it going. But It's fun in general working on Rusty Staples. The comics on TV articles are tremendous fun to do. It's when someone spots a comic in an old British TV show and they let me know, or I might find it myself. And you just have to track down the individual issues because reasons. You have to. It's the law.
Yeah.
It's very satisfying when you find the right issue of Pippin or something like that. And you go, yes. So thank you, Call the Midwife, for all the good comics in here. So yes, yeah, so Rusty Staples is it's not meant to be a news blog. I've tried to avoid doing news in general. It's an olds blog rather than news. But it's good fun, usually.
It's a great resource for British comics, along with, as you say, Richard Sheaf's Boys Adventure Comics blog, and of course John Freeman's Down the Tube. So yeah, follow the links in the show notes to michaelowencarroll.wordpress.com to find more about the Rusty Staples blog, which is splendid stuff, Michael.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Michael, for giving up your time this Thursday morning to talk about Razorjack and about your own work and your blogging as well. And good luck with Silver in the Prog. I hope we get many more books.
So do I. Yeah, thank you very much. It's been great fun. And thank you for we finally got here. Hey,
finally got here, yes. And we may bump into each other again next year, either at Loras or maybe at Enniskillen next year.
I hope so. It would be definitely. They're both tremendous events, and I would very much like to return to both, and also very much like to be a millionaire. Just in case it's happening. Yeah.
And then we would be able to buy you that John Higgins page.
Hey, yeah. John would just give it to me if I ask. I'm sure.
Thank you very much, Michael.
You're very welcome, Emma. Thank you.
And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. Find all these links we've been talking about at megacitybookclub.com. We're on all the socials apart from the horrible X, which we've come off completely. Which socials can we find you on, Michael?
Well, I've got my website, michaelowencarroll.com, and that has links to my Facebook and X and all of these things. My Instagram, though I still don't know how to use Instagram. I just post stuff on it and then just leave it. But yeah, Facebook is where I'm most likely to be active. For the moment. Again, all my links, michaelowencarroll.com. You'll find me there. And also, buy my books. Thank you.
Excellent stuff. You can email me at mcbcpodcast@gmail.com if you've got a book that you want to come on and talk about. And that will do us. Until next time, when we're passing judgment on another great book, it's goodbye from me and...
It's goodbye from him. Thank you.